morning, everyone. It is good to see you. Let's get started. Okay, we're at the end of Vayikra, which I'm feeling kind of sad about, but I understand is a relief for some people. We're this week going to be focused, this week is technically a double parsha, Bahar B'chukotai, but both sessions are going to be on snippets from Vayikra Rabba about B'chukotai. And we're actually going to start this week with the very last midrash in Vayikra Rabba. So let's jump in. The midrash is going to focus on the snippet in Vayikra Rabba that is about if you vow to give the worth of a person to the Beit HaMikdash, how much is that actually? And it goes into detail. So let's look for a moment at the verse. V'edaber Hashem el Moshe lemor, daber el b'nei Yisrael, v'amarta alehem, ish ki yafli neder, ba'erchecha nefashot l'Hashem. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the Israelite people and say to them, when anyone explicitly vows to the Lord, the equivalent for a human being. Now, what I want us to pay attention to is the way that this is going to set off almost alarm bells for the Midrash. And this works in two ways. One, the Midrash is jumping in explicitly on the idea of nedarim, of vows. When are they appropriate and when are they inappropriate? But two, there is something in this verse, in these verses, that almost draws us uncomfortably close to the idea of human sacrifice. And by this I mean, the verses are in no way saying that human sacrifice is in any way an option, but it is almost in a way a concession to the human instinct that the proper thing to offer to God is the thing that is worth the most to you, i.e. human beings. And what the verse does is essentially say, instead of doing that, what you do is offer the monetary worth of that person, which we go on to define. The Midrash, though, is going to pick up on those darker implications and bring us through to places where it seems like that almost happened. And we'll see how that works. We're going to be looking at four snippets from Tanakh. Four different stories of people who vowed in ways that could have ended up tragic. And then we're going to see a snippet at the end from Tehillim, from Psalms, where the Midrash gives us a different view. Actually, this is the proper way for a vow to work. This is the proper religious inclination behind it. Let's jump in. Four made vows. Three in an improper way, and God answered them in a proper way, and one in an improper way, and God answered him in an improper way. And these are they: Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, Shaul, Yiftach, and Kalev. So four people made vows that were inappropriate in some way. Three of them, God actually answered kindly in such a way that everything turned out okay. And one of them, God did not. Line 2. Eliezer asked in an improper way, as it says, let the maiden to whom I say, please lower your jar that I may drink, and who replies, drink, and I will also water your camels, let her be the one who you have decreed for your servant Isaac. Thereby shall I know that you have dealt graciously with my master. So, Abraham's servant, who is not identified in the pshat of the text as Eliezer, but who the Midrash assumes is Eliezer, makes a vow to God, or at least what the Midrash here is identifying as a vow, and says, here's how I know who will be the correct person for Yitzchak to marry. This is where Abraham sends him to find a wife for Yitzchak. If I ask for a drink and she says yes, and also your camels she'll drink, she'll be the right one. The Midrash jumps in with what the problem is. Namely, the Holy One said, If a Canaanite slave or a prostitute had been the one, would you have said, let her be the one who you have decreed for your servant Isaac? God arranged that the woman who fulfilled the vow was Rivka. So what we have here is God looking at this condition and saying, you are playing with people's lives here. You are playing with Yitzchak's marriage here. You are playing with the ultimate outcome of his life and also essentially the Jewish people. You think that you are doing a pious thing by leaving it in my hands, by saying, here's the condition, and then whatever you, God, control who fulfills the condition. But actually, your piety is misplaced. Your piety is actually in some way saying, I abandon responsibility, the very responsibility that I've been given. And although God identifies this as improper, God, in the end, decides to fulfill the condition with Rivka, fulfill it in a proper way. Let's keep going. And what I'd like us to keep in mind as we go on, the Midrash is not going to give us an explicit reason why God answers three of these people in a kind way and one in an unkind way. But I'd like us to think about that in the background. Is there something different about the three that God answers in a kind way than the one that God answers in an unkind way? Line 3. Caleb asked inappropriately, as it says, I will give my daughter Achsa in marriage to the man who attacks and captures, captures Kiryat Sefer. God replied to him. So here we have almost an inverse. Here, instead of this man's marriage will depend on whatever woman first fulfills this condition, here it is, my daughter's marriage will depend on whoever first fulfills this condition. God replied to him, and if a Canaanite slave or mamzer had conquered it, what then? Would you have still fulfilled this vow? God arranged for him that his brother would conquer it, as it says, and I apologize, the English is missing the translation. But the translation is, and Otniel ben Kenaz conquered it, Ve'elkedah Otniel ben Kenaz, who is actually Caleb's brother. Line 4. Sha'ul asked inappropriately, as it says, the man who kills him will be rewarded by the king with great riches. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and grant exemption to his father's house in Israel. Does anyone remember where this is from, what the context is? Who does Sha'ul want killed? Who does he offer a reward for killing? So David's the one who fulfills the condition, and it's exactly as Linda said, for killing Goliath. Amazing. God said to him, if an Ammonite or a Mamzer or a slave had killed him, would you have given him your daughter? God arranged for David to be the one and gave him his daughter, Michal. Just before we go into the last one, I want to read Naomi Zaslow's comment. It seems as if women's bodies are the ones that get to be offered. Yes, very much. And Melinda Zalma replied in response to Naomi, yes, three in marriage and one in sacrifice. What's interesting is that the Midrash chooses to open with Yitzchak being the one who's up for grabs in marriage. There's a lot to be said about that, especially with some of the classic gender role swapping that happens between Yitzchak and his wife Rivka. In many ways, Yitzchak functions in that paradigm almost as more as the role of a woman than what we usually see with the Avot, but we can talk about that towards the end if there's a chance. Now we're up to the person who asks improperly. Yiftach asked inappropriately, as it says, then whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me on my safe return from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's and shall be offered as a burnt offering. God said, And if the first thing to exit had been a camel or a donkey or a dog, would you have offered it as a sacrifice? God arranged for his daughter to be the first to exit. As it says, on seeing her, he rent his clothes. So let's just take a moment here. Yiftach made a vow in return for victory in war. And he says, if I have victory in war, then the first thing to come out of my house upon my return, I will offer as a sacrifice. And as the story in the Tanakh goes, the first thing to come to the door was actually his own daughter coming to celebrate his victory. And the Midrash here is contrasting this with the other three vows where God essentially saves the person from their own religious folly. Here, God does not take it upon God's self to save Yiftach. Rather, God actually arranges for it to be his daughter who arrives at the door. And again, the question I want us to have in mind right now is why? Why would God somehow save the first three people from their own religious folly? And why does God refuse to save Yiftach? I'm just going to read two responses that came in so far. Bracha says, chances are high it would be his daughter. Exactly, you're coming home from war. Your family is going to be excited to go out to greet you. And often in Tanakh, we actually see that that role fills to women who celebrate the men when they come home from war. Melinda Zama, in Yiftach, there is no proper way out. How could a cow or sheep cross his doorway? Or is it talking about his property? So I think you're onto something there. I think you're onto this actually isn't something that Yiftach thought through. And the Midrash gives us little hints to that. It says a donkey or a dog, which might have been more likely to be those things than something more domesticated. Sorry, not domesticated. Something more likely to be kept in a pen, like a sheep or a cow. Naomi says, Yiftach offered a sacrifice where everyone else offered marriage. Additionally, it was for personal saving. Exactly. I want to highlight this point. Yiftach brings us back to the departure point in our psukim of there is this dark inclination in human beings towards human sacrifice. I'm not saying that the Midrash is saying subconsciously Yiftach wanted to give a human sacrifice, but the Midrash is bringing us back to the psukim about just how careful do you have to be with vows concerning life, with vows concerning sacrifice. I'm going to read a few more, and then we're going to jump back to the text. Sharon Perlman, maybe it's because the first three are about marriage, and with Yiftach, it's about winning a war. Interesting. So Yiftach is the only one that, well, possibly also Shaul, because he was fighting Goliath, but Judith's comment for Yiftach, it was for his own glory. Those two coupled together bring us to a very new conclusion. This is actually about ego here as opposed to something else. David Kaplan, similarly, the other three would or could benefit the Jewish people as a whole. Yiftach is all about him, and we're going to see how the Midrash follows that theme. Paul and Leah, it isn't Yiftach who needs to be saved. Why is God so indifferent to the fate of Yiftach's daughter? Great, so the Midrash is about to do something where it's essentially going to argue it's not God who's indifferent, and we'll see that. I'm not going to get to all of these, but I'm going to try to come back to these in a moment, just so that we can get through the Midrash, but I'm loving this so far. These are really great insights. Okay, so we're right now at the moment where God has allowed and actually even caused Yiftach's daughter to be the first one to exit the house. Line number 6. He could have annulled his vow by going to Pinchas. Pinchas is the Kohen Gadol at the time. And the idea is that the Kohen Gadol or other Chachamim have the ability to annul vows by finding essentially gaps in them. And this is classically done through if you had known X, Y, and Z at the time you made the vow, would you have made the vow? Sort of mechanism. So he could have annulled his vow by going to Pinchas. He said, should I, a king, a little bit strange because Yiftach is not actually a king, but he is indeed a chieftain, go to Pinchas And Pinchas said, should I, a Kohen Gadol, son of a Kohen Gadol, go to an ignoramus? Between the two of them, this unfortunate girl was lost, and the two of them were responsible for her death. So I want to come back to what a few comments were weighing in about. A few comments pointed to this is actually about ego, rather than any sort of greater purpose. And the Midrash here seems to be backing that explicitly. Rebecca Whitman asks, does Pinchas know about the vow? It seems in this he does. And he's actually refusing to seek out Yiftach in order to help him annul it. What's actually happening here is that a story about there's nothing I can do, I made this vow to God, I'm religiously obligated, as it appears in the plain text, the Midrash is reading that and saying, no. You know what that piety was about? That piety was actually about the ego of two great men who were between the two of them willing to allow a young girl to die in the name of ostensibly their piety. And I want to make sure we notice just how radical isn't quite the right word. Maybe someone else can give me the right word. The Midrash is being here. The Midrash is looking at what can be interpreted as a story of the utmost piety, a story about I will fulfill my vow to God no matter what, and saying, actually, not only was that not the correct religious impulse, that is something that human beings sometimes use to cover up their own flaws, to cover up their own ego. Be very careful about when your devotion to God, devotion to fulfilling the law, is actually about devotion to your own pride. Robert Niederman says, so they did actually sacrifice her. It seems in this midrash they do. There are other midrashim that have her going to something like the first Jewish convent rather than being actually sacrificed. Melinda Zalma, the rabbis do a beautiful job in addressing a very troubling part of the Tanakh. This is one of the reasons I love Midrash. Same. We're not the first ones to be troubled when reading our sacred texts. I 100% agree. And I also think that not only are they addressing something that's troubling, they're doing it as very good readers. They understand Yiftach's character. They understand and they draw the implications of Yiftach's character all the way through to this incident. I think I missed something because F. Shraga said something about Abraham heard directly from God, so different, but maybe he still should have argued. A comparison to Akedat Yitzchak. I see. That's very interesting. Joe Schwartz, where else does the story appear? It seems familiar, maybe from somewhere else in the Talmud. So just to answer Joe Schwartz's question, I believe it appears at least one other time where they compare explicitly Yiftach's vow in offering his daughter, essentially, to Chana's vow, where she says, I will give my son to God, but she never means it as a sacrifice, she means to serve. When I teach Shmuel, I really like to use that midrash because it's actually about two very different sort of religious instincts. What does it mean to offer to God? But happy to chat about that some other time. Okay, let's jump back to line 7. Between the two of them, this unfortunate girl was lost, and the two of them were responsible for her death. Pinchas had the divine insight, Ruach HaKodesh, removed from him, as it says, and Pinchas, son of Eleazar, was the chief officer over them in times past. The Lord was with him. So the Midrash picks up on the fact that the Pasuk in Divrei Hayamim in Chronicles says, in times past, the Spirit of the Lord was with him, and says that at some point, actually because of this, Ruach HaKodesh, the divine spirit was cut off from him. Yiftach was hacked apart limb by limb and buried. As it says, then Yiftach the Giladi died, and he was buried in the towns of Gilad. It does not say in the town of Gilad, singular, but in the towns of Gilad, plural. This teaches that he was hacked apart limb by limb and buried in many places. Not going to touch that because no one needs to think about that in graphic detail before 9 a.m. All right, we're finishing up here. Rish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan disagreed about this matter being what should Yiftach have done, or what was Yiftach obligated to do in this moment. Rish Lakish said he should have donated money for sacrifices to be brought on the altar. So he should have done exactly what our Pasuk says when you have the inclination to give the value of a person to the Mishkan or the Mikdash, you give it in a form of money. Rabbi Yochanan said he was not even obligated to give money, as we teach in a Mishnah. Something that is worthy to be offered on the altar shall be offered. Something that is unworthy to be offered shall not be offered. So because he initially made this vow in a form that was actually about this will be offered as a sacrifice, there's no way to kind of circle back and then make that acceptable in the form of offering money. Your vow to offer something that is not acceptable to be offered is no vow at all, or at least it can never be fulfilled. And not only that, but anyone who makes a vow and fulfills it shall merit to fulfill it in Jerusalem. As it says, I will pay my vows to the Lord. Where? In the courts of the house of the Lord, in the midst of Jerusalem. Hallelujah. As it says, praise the Lord, for he is good, his steadfast love is eternal. Why can't the inappropriate things be offered? Because the promise is that when you fulfill your vows to God, not only do you do that by bringing whatever offering you have offered at this moment, but you will be destined to bring in the future offerings to God in Jerusalem, in rebuilt Jerusalem specifically, in the times of Mashiach. Robert Niederman says, do we make vows to the Lord now? I believe there are people who do, meaning some people make vows to God to give to Tzedakah instead of to the Beit HaMikdash. But I think theoretically it is possible to make a vow to bring something in the rebuilt Beit HaMikdash. There are actually stories of people throughout the ages who have noted down when they've committed transgressions that would obligate them to bring korbanot, to bring offerings in the Beit HaMikdash in a little notebook, so that should they still be alive at the point when Mashiach comes, they can know exactly what they're obligated to bring in Jerusalem, which I think is very lovely. Ariana Barrow says, so the various townspeople were appalled by what Yiftach did. Yeah, that didn't occur to me. That's very interesting. That's very interesting. You're reading that as actually human beings are appalled and they carry out punishment for Yiftach. Paul and Leah Jenner said, none of this helps Yiftach's daughter. She's still dead. Yes. And I don't want us to forget that point. And I'm going to read the follow-up. It seems true to me that this vow should have been invalid automatically. Isn't spilling human blood outside of war explicitly forbidden? Yeah, and I think that Reish Lakish, I think that Rabbi Yochanan is right there with you. Part of what I think the Midrash accomplishes by bringing us to the end of she dies, she is killed, rather than the less violent ends that other Midrashim give us, is actually saying this is what misplaced piety can cause. This is what misplaced piety, when piety is actually covering for your own ego, which is such a common human failing, can cause. It actually does result in the death of innocence. And the Midrash isn't going to spare us from that end. The Midrash is actually saying, I want you to look at this closely so that you know what the dangers here are. Joe, it's similar to this Greek story of Agamemnon and Iphigenia. Yeah, that's a great point. Robert Niederman asks the question, the ultimate question for this Midrash, but how can we prevent this kind of error? I'd love for people to weigh in on that in the chat. One thing that occurs to me is that in this Midrash, the way pride plays out is by people refusing to go to each other. It seems to me that the Midrash is offering that potentially when you are willing to go to other people, when you are willing to say, I have a problem, can you help me solve it? that might be one curb to that sort of religious ego, to that sort of misplaced piety. It's essentially offering fellowship and community as a sort of barrier to this. Ashraga offers self-reflection and review of own piety. Yeah, although I also wonder, up until what point is that useful? When does that help you break through? And when do you just get stuck in a chain of mirrors that are just reflecting back what you want to think? Shana Perlman, or admitting made a mistake as Yiftach could have done. The most difficult thing, absolutely. Absolutely. Sarah Bamberger, interesting that partial blame is placed on Pinchas. Yeah. And part of what I love about that is it's saying you as, if you are in leadership, you do not have the ability to just look aside and say, let other people's religious instincts be their own downfall. You actually have an obligation to step in and say, I think we have a problem here. What can we do? Ashraga says, when self-reflection not enough, others needed community necessary. Yeah. Joe Schwartz, perhaps Yiftach knew it could have been a family member and was just willing to risk it. I think that's a very interesting read. I think it's possible because we see that from that point on in Shoftim, there is an increasing indifference to human life. He does seem to be distraught, though, when his daughter comes out. Last few comments, and then we're going to close up for this morning. Rebecca Whitman, our skills are conditional and have to be used for good. Where Pinchas doesn't use his insight to save the girl, he loses it. And Yiftach kills his daughter and loses his might, his life. I think that was the perfect place to close. That's an amazing insight. Pinchas doesn't use his religious insight, so he loses the divine insight. And Yiftach uses his might inappropriately, so he actually loses it by being killed. We're going to close out here. I'm wishing everyone a good week, a week of good religious instincts, and I hope to see a lot of you back on Thursday. Have a great week, everyone.